you've heard any of my previous episodes, you'll know I tend to say a lot of, oh, I'll cover that in a future episode.
Yeah, fob us off, why don't you?
And I think that the segmentation, targeting and positioning concept has come up quite a few times. So I wanted to put this episode together to really cover that process. I think it's a really valuable concept to get your head around because it's absolutely fundamental to the marketing process. Given that it's a process, I'm expecting this episode to be a bit more linear than previous episodes, but we'll see. So I'm hopefully going to make segmentation, targeting and positioning a bit more clear.
Let's find out. The marketing game is about to change up. Yeah. Dropping something new and it's major. Everything that you need is right here. I'm talking marketing made clear. Go. Helping you to elevate from beginner to a pro. Ain't a better way. Marketing made clear. It's showtime. Wanna see you win. Wanna see you shine. I love myself a bit of marketing.
Welcome to Marketing Made Clear. I'm your host, Will Green, and I'm joined by my assistant, Marketing Artificial Intelligence Technology, otherwise known as Mate.
What are you looking at?
There's no need for that, is there? So like I said in the intro, today's topic covers something absolutely fundamental to marketing. It might not be the most sexy headline for an episode, but I really hope that if I can get this bit right and help you understand this concept, I could help you either really solidify your marketing knowledge in this area or take a giant leap.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the first thing I really need to do is provide you with the context of segmentation, targeting, and positioning. So I'm going to tackle that first. Because us marketers don't always universally agree on how to go about utilising segmentation, targeting and positioning within the wider remit of marketing. So I'll cover the models first. After that, we'll have a look at some definitions and then we'll dive into each area in turn, starting with segmentation, moving to targeting and ending with positioning. Hopefully that will then bring the episode back round to the wider process so that I can answer some common questions about segmentation, targeting and positioning. And then you'll be ready to do your masters in marketing, of course. There's no place for trends or haters or heroes today because I've pretty much just used all my beautiful books for this episode.
N-E-R-D nerd.
Yes, I am.
You're not a chic nerd though. You're like a proper nerd.
That's all good with me. I'm not bothered. So without further babbling, let's have a look at the generic model of segmentation, targeting and positioning.
Budapest is the capital of what European country?
I thought Europe was a country. But like, I know they speak French there, don't they? Like, I want to say, is France a country? I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I'm listening to what you're saying, but I only hear what I want to.
Okay, so like I said, most people adopt a different model of segmentation, targeting, and positioning, otherwise known as STP, and I'll try and use STP as much as I can. So when I say STP, I mean segmentation, targeting, and positioning. But the good news is about the STP part of the model is that most people actually agree on that. So what I mean by that is that most people agree that you do segment the audience, then you target them, and then you position your product or service to them. Where things vary are the steps before and after the STP stages. And people tend to refer to this wider process as the marketing management process. Again, that's a pretty generic term for a generic model, which could get confusing, but that's just what people call it.
Do you have a guess?
I don't think France is a country, but I would have said that. I don't know. I'm just going to say France. I don't know.
Okay. France is a country. I will tell you that. The right answer is Hungary.
Is what?
Hungary.
Hungary?
Like I'm hungry.
That's a country? Now, I've heard of Turkey, but Hungary? Never heard of it.
The other thing that can vary is the steps within segmentation, targeting and positioning. Let's call them sub-steps. They're steps that are within the wider steps of segmentation, targeting or positioning. So in these more elaborate models, there are two steps of segmentation, two steps to targeting and two steps to positioning. So because of this, some people view it as a six-step model instead of a three-step model. But I don't think that matters too much. It's just worth mentioning. You'll need to use your imagination to follow with me on this, But if you can picture three stages for now, that will stand you in good stead for this segment. So, then we're really looking at the different ways that people frame the STP part of the model, as in what goes before and after the STP part. This first bit is easy because these wider models usually start with some form of research. This can be labelled as research, as a generic term, or market research, or a situation analysis. It's all basically the same thing. Our old mate Kotler is a fan of this first stage, and he outlines in his book, Kotler and Marketing, which I very highly recommend, and Gilligan and Wilson also use this initial stage in their book, Strategic Marketing Planning. So what I'm saying is this is very well accepted academically, but before you do any form of segmentation, you need some form of research to contextualize the next part of the process. If you think about it, how can you segment the market without any understanding of it? A lot of this goes back to strategy and knowing what your strategy is. And if you listen to the episode that I did on strategy, you know that there was a lot of emphasis on research and objectives. So, Kotler says at this stage that
research is the starting point for marketing. Without research, a company enters a market like a blind man.
Thank you, mate. In his book, Kotler gives an example about a Hong Kong shoe manufacturer who wonders whether a market exists for his shoes on a remote South Pacific island. He sends an order taker to the island who, on a cursory examination, writes back,
"The people here don't wear shoes, there's no market."
But not convinced, the Hong Kong shoe manufacturer sends a salesman to the island. This salesman writes back,
"The people here don't wear shoes, there is a tremendous market."
Which makes me think we're coming back to perspectives again, which is something we've talked about before. But afraid the salesman was being carried away by the sight of so many shoeless feet, the Hong Kong manufacturer sends the third person, this time a marketer. This marketing professional interviews the tribal chief and several of the natives and finally writes back,
"The people here don't wear shoes. However, they have bad feet. I have shown the chief how shoes would help his people avoid foot problems. He is enthusiastic. He estimates 70% of his people will buy the shoes at the price of $10 a pair. We probably can sell 5,000 pairs of shoes in the first year. Our cost of bringing the shoes to the island and setting up distribution would amount to $6 a pair. We will clear $20,000 the first year, which, given our investment, would give us a rate of return on our investment, ROI, of 20%, which exceed a normal ROI of 15%. This is not to mention the high value of our future earnings by entering this market. I recommend we go ahead."
Okay, so this example demonstrates how careful research into the market opportunity and the preparation of financial estimates helps indicate whether the returns would meet the company's financial objectives. Research helps a company to recognize that buyers in any market will normally differ in their needs, perceptions, and preferences. Of course, for shoes, there are so many different requirements from consumers, balancing practicalities, body shapes, fashions, and all sorts of other elements like disposable income and other tastes. So hopefully you can see that when it comes to research, Kotler tends to focus on consumer research. But Gilligan and Wilson differ because they focus on the company at this stage. So basically, Kotler looks outwards and Gilligan and Wilson look inwards. So with Gilligan and Wilson, instead of calling this a research stage, they call it a situation analysis. And within that, they say that it's important to identify the organization's current position, capabilities, objectives, and constraints. I would say that it's actually a good idea to have an understanding of both your wider market and your situational analysis. You could probably carry out a lot of this by using models like a SWOT analysis or a PESTEL analysis. To a lesser extent, you could use the Boston Growth Share Matrix, Porter's Generic Strategies, Kotler's Pricing Model, a Stakeholder Analysis, or Ansoff's Product and Marketing Mix. It's up to you, really. So once you have that research, you can move on to segmentation, which I'll come back round to in more detail. But Since Kotler's very early publications, he has suggested that segmentation has two substages. And these stages have also been adopted by other academics, such as Gilligan and Wilson, which makes it really easy because I just have to tell you one iteration of substages of market segmentation, which are, number one, you identify segmentation variables and segment the market, and then two, you develop profiles of resulting segments. I'll come back round to segmentation to talk about them in a bit more detail, but that's all you need to know for now. So then, after segmentation, we can move on to targeting, which is all about targeting the resulting segments. And again, it's widely accepted that this is split into two stages, which includes, number one, evaluating the potential and attractiveness of each segment, and then number two, selecting the target segments. The final stage in the STP part of the models is positioning. And again, it's widely agreed that this is broken into two stages. Number one is identifying the positioning concept for each target segment. And then number two is selecting and developing the appropriate positioning concept for each segment. Whichever way you look at it, if we count all these substages as individual stages, we have now reached stage 7 of the overriding process, which includes segmentation, targeting and positioning. But that's where the marketing management process generic model thing starts to differ.
Ooh, yeah. I'm going to have to go ahead and sort of disagree with you there.
Saying that though, stage 8 is fairly well accepted as developing the marketing mix strategy, which is really about choosing the activities that are going to be used to implement some form of campaign. And this is where the dreaded 7 Ps come back in. This calls back to strategy again, because with all the information that would have been refined up until this point, this could have a huge amount of influence on the company's objectives. But I covered strategy already in episode 2, so give that a listen if you haven't already. So this is where the Gilligan and Wilson model ends, as an 8-stage process, but Kotler adds a further 2 stages, which is not only greedy, but means that academic marketers have to debate this. But for Kotler, stage 9 involves implementation, which in his words is
producing the designated product, pricing it, distributing it, and promoting it.
So this is the actual doing, and it includes more than just the marketing department. Whereas I guess you could argue all the stages up to this point are heavily marketing focused. And then the final 10th stage that Kotler sets out is control. And this involves getting feedback, evaluating results, and revising or improving the STP strategy and marketing tactics. Kotler says that
successful companies are learning companies. They collect feedback from the marketplace, audit and evaluate results, and make corrections designed to improve their performance.
So that kind of sets the scene. I really hope that I haven't lost you already. So hopefully we can move on to talking about segmentation, targeting, and then positioning in isolation without having to worry about going into too much detail about the research stage beforehand and too many of the elements towards the end of the process, like the actual implementation and evaluation of the marketing. So let's move on to definitions.
Defining definitions.
Definitions are concise explanations or descriptions that aim to clarify the meaning of a word, term, concept, or idea. They serve as linguistic guidelines, providing context and understanding within a language.
Definitions.
Okay, so I need to be a bit careful to make sure we don't start citing non-marketing related uses of the word segmentation, targeting, and positioning, because these can obviously mean totally different things in a different context. So I've used Investopedia here, which I know wouldn't be acceptable for academics, but these are pretty good as a starting point. Anyway, Investopedia defines market segmentation as
market segmentation is a way of aggregating prospective buyers into groups or segments based on demographics, geography, behavior, or psychographic factors in order to better understand and market to them.
And note that I have used the term market segmentation because there are actually so many different types of segmentation within the topic of marketing, and these can make things a little bit confusing. As an example, product segmentation is totally different. Product segmentation is a marketing strategy that involves dividing a company's products into different categories to meet the needs of specific customer groups. So that's actually more related to targeting and positioning. So when we're talking about segmentation, we're talking about segmenting the audience or the customer base. As Investopedia say,
prospective buyers.
but we're basically talking about grouping people. And more specifically, we're talking about using information we know about people through research, namely data collection, possibly during the sales process or possibly through some form of research, to ultimately split the wider audience into more specific groups. And as Investopedia say, marketers tend to do that based on four areas: demographics, geography, behavior, or psychographic factors. This will be massively based on the product or service that you're trying to sell and the data that you have available to you, with the purpose of being able to actually target people based on that selection. If you can't actually split that database based on the information that's available to you, then you can't segment them. Right, so let's have a look at targeting. Investopedia defines the marketing term targeting as:
a target market is a group of people that have been identified as the most likely potential customers for a product because of their shared characteristics, such as age, income, and lifestyle. Identifying the target market is a key part of the decision-making process when a company designs, packages, and advertises its product.
Yeah, so this carries on from what I was just saying about segmentation. But targeting is about actively going after that profile of customer. I'd say that linking back to the definition of segmentation, we have to take those four elements into consideration again. And that was demographics, geography, behavior, or psychographic factors. So we're looking for shared characteristics across any of these four areas relevant to targeting. Then when we get into positioning, Investopedia defines the marketing term positioning as:
a marketing strategy that involves influencing how consumers perceive a product or brand relative to its competitors. The goal is to establish a favorable image or identity for the product or brand in the minds of consumers. This can help businesses establish a unique identity, impact consumer perceptions and purchasing decisions, and build long-term customer loyalty.
So I think the positioning can be one of the most interesting areas of the process, because sometimes you'll take the same product and position it differently for different segments. This will be down to your research. And if we're talking about a food-related product, it might be because one segment buys a food product because of its ethical properties, and another segment may buy a food product because of its taste, and another segment may buy a food product because of its health benefits. This might be the exact same product, but packaged and presented differently to each of these segments. But as Investopedia says, the goal is to establish a favourable image or identity for the product in the minds of consumers. And this is related to the unique selling points and the value proposition that we discussed in quite a lot of detail in the marketing strategy episode. Lovely. So I think we've cracked definitions. Let's start to deep dive into each area, starting, of course, with segmentation.
I think it's a pretty good plan. We should be able to pull it off this time. What do you think, Abdul? Can you give me a number crunch real quick? Oh, it's a lot better than we usually do.
All right, thumbs up.
Ready, guys?
Let's do this. Leroy Jenkins!
Oh my god, he just ran in.
Right, so segmentation. Fundamentally, the need for segmentation comes from the understanding that companies, products, and services cannot appeal to all buyers in the marketplace, or at least not to all buyers in the same way. Back in the bad old days of marketing, if you asked big brands about who their target customers were, they would say, everybody. But buyers are too varied in their needs and buying practices, and companies vary in their ability to serve different segments of the market. And that might be practically in the sense that they physically can't serve a particular region, or maybe more nuanced, like lacking some cultural appeal or just not being known by that audience. So companies need to identify the parts of a market that it can serve best and most profitably, because that's another thing. A company might be able to serve an audience, but not at any profit, because overheads like supply chain and transportation mean that it's just not feasible. There's a phrase from Kotler that I've used quite a few times, but it's worth reiterating again.
Good marketing is about building the right relationships with the right customers.
So, companies need to be choosy about who they develop relationships with. And the idea is moving away from mass marketing and towards market segmentation and targeting. And this might involve developing products that better suit that segment, or just developing the marketing strategy around that segment, keeping the product the same, or anything in between, like using different forms of packaging for different audiences. The most obvious version of that is adapting packaging for different regions and different languages and stuff like that. The concept of marketing segmentation dates right back to the 1950s, but it wasn't until the 1970s that the concepts of targeting and positioning really evolved, which is where we get this full-formed STP process. Again, I mentioned this in the definition section, but there are other forms of segmentation, like product segmentation, which is when a company modifies its product into several different products in order to attract different kinds of customers or target different markets. Market segmentation simply modifies your marketing strategy, not necessarily the product itself. Wendell R. Smith is generally credited to be the first person to introduce the concept of marketing segmentation as a theoretical concept, but a lot of people argue the practice of segmentation was already in place, which is just what naturally happens when the product finds their audience. But for this to happen naturally, it's almost trial and error. By using segmentation, you're giving yourself a fighting chance for this to happen properly before you go out of business. One of the great examples used to illustrate segmentation dates right back to the 1800s, when Robert Southey and or Eleanor Muir wrote down the folktale Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
You have got to be kidding me, Will.i.am. This feels like a jump, even for you.
Bear with me on this one, mate. Pun intended, of course.
Go on then, but I'm skeptical.
Okay. Well, here we go. Goldilocks and the Three Bears can be viewed as an allegory for marketing segmentation by illustrating the importance of understanding and catering to different consumer preferences within a market.
I don't know.
Firstly, the Three Bears represent different market segments. Papa Bear represents a segment that prefers large or big products and services. This segment might be interested in high-end, premium products with more features, larger sizes, or more robust offerings. Whereas Mama Bear represents a segment that prefers medium or more balanced products and services. This group is looking for the middle ground, balancing quality, size, and price. And then you've got Baby Bear. Baby Bear represents a segment that prefers small or light products and services. This could be a budget-conscious group or one that values simplicity and ease of use.
I guess so, but is that it?
No, because there's more. Because, secondly, if you view Goldilocks as the consumer, the character who tries out all the options presented by the Three Bears, this symbolises the process of a consumer navigating through different market offerings. She samples each one, the porridge, the chair, then the bed. And she finds some too extreme, so too hot, too cold, too big, too small, and eventually finds one that is just right. That reflects the consumer's search for a product or service that fits their unique preferences and needs.
That does make sense, I have to
say. I'm not done yet. Because thirdly, there is finding the right fit. The story emphasised that not all consumers will be satisfied with a one-size-fits-all approach. Just as Goldilocks rejects the porridge, chair and the bed that don't suit her, consumers will reject products that don't meet their specific needs. This highlights the importance of segmentation, where businesses offer different products to cater for the diverse needs within a market.
Okay, point proved. Move on.
Well, I'm not quite done. Because with product differentiation, the different options provided by the bears, again, porridge, chairs and beds, can be seen as product differentiation, where a company offers a range of products to appeal to various segments. This strategy helps capture a broader market by acknowledging that different consumers have different tastes and requirements. Mate, you still there? Okay, well, then finally, that takes us to consumer choice and satisfaction. The ultimate satisfaction of Goldilocks with the just right products highlights the goal of effective marketing segmentation, which is to ensure that each segment finds a product that perfectly matches its needs, leading to customer satisfaction and loyalty. So, in summary, Goldilocks and the Three Bears serves as a metaphor for marketing segmentation by illustrating how different market segments have unique needs and how different businesses must provide differentiated offerings to satisfy the diverse preferences effectively.
I bloody hate it when you're right.
Cool, thanks, mate. So just to reiterate that point in there, that the goal of effective marketing segmentation is to ensure that each segment finds a product that perfectly matches its needs, leading to customer satisfaction and loyalty. So it's all about relevance. And marketers can begin to segment audiences using demographics, geography, behaviour or psychographic factors. This leads to more targeted advertising and product development to improve or highlight aspects of a product that will better align to the demands of a consumer. So this might be a little bit boring, but I guess it would be good to get it out of the way just to list off some of the variables that we can be talking about when we're talking about each of these categories. I'm going to use Mate for some of this because they can talk through this much quicker than I can, and they can do it in one take as well, which is great. So geographic variables include world, region or country. So you might be targeting the whole of the world, I don't know, or you might be targeting Europe or Western Europe, or you might target the UK. You might target a region within the country, so this could be broader regions like targeting Tuscany in Italy or a county in the UK like Yorkshire.
I tell you what though, folks, that's bloody nice. That is bloody lovely.
It's possible that you might be marketing a product or service that's only available to a certain region, so you would have a very bespoke geographical region there. You might also have restrictions on where you can sell your product. So you'd have the majority of a region, but you have to exclude somewhere. A great example of this is with raw dog food, where you're dispatching a frozen product. Unfortunately, the Scottish Highlands and the remote islands of Scotland are too far away to deliver a frozen product to.
Ever interrupt me again, I'll kick your tits off your face.
So the target area is the whole of the UK without these regions and without Northern Ireland, come to think of it as well. So these are pretty clear, but you can target other things like town or city size or population density. This might be useful if you have a product that is for people living in larger cities and can be particularly relevant for certain apps. You can also target by climate, like targeting the Mediterranean or just targeting temperate regions or tropical regions. And obviously this is more relevant to the products that are more akin to a warmer climate like air conditioning. So that's geographic. And next up is demographic, which I think is the most easily understood. So I'll let Mate take this one from here.
Okay, home slice. Demographic variables include age, gender, family size, life cycle stage like single, married, married to children, etc. Income, including individual or household income. Occupation, education, religion, ethnicity, generation like baby boomer, generation X, generation Y, or the snowflake generations.
Whoa, you can't say that.
Can't say what?
Snowflake generation, you can't say that.
Well, I just did.
Okay, now you're being petulant. If you can't do this properly, I'll just take over.
Be my guest, I only had one left anyway, which was nationality.
Okay, well, thanks for that. On the most part, you did all right. But isn't nationality geographical?
No, Mr. Smarty Pants, because people with nationalities can move to different geographies, just like your family did, you should know that, you bloody prick.
Right, thank you. Demographic information is fairly standard. But there are some new ways to use demographic information with the tools that we have available to us. And going back 10 years ago or so, I was in a wedding band and I used to run very specific Facebook adverts that used demographic information. And this was to show adverts to people in a certain region that were newly engaged. Obviously on Facebook, it's quite a big thing to change your status to engaged and it's part of the excitement. But it was a really good tool for us to target people that had just got engaged and lived in areas that as a band we could play in. So we've covered geographic and demographic, but the next two areas are a little bit more complex and debatable, I would say, as well. So firstly, we have psychographic. And psychographic variables tend to come under three headers, which are
social class, lifestyle, and personality.
The social class variable has never really sat well with me, but it's quite well accepted in marketing segmentation, so I suppose I should cover it. But please take the following with a pinch of salt. Because social class includes
lower uppers, upper lowers, working class, middle class, upper middles, upper uppers.
Life cycle psychographics I can get a little bit more on board with. And these can include stuff like
achievers, strivers, and survivors.
Which to me is all well and good, but what data do you hold that's actually going to tell you with any degree of certainty that somebody is going to belong to one of these lifestyle groups? Well, we'll come back to that. But lifestyle segmentation can also include things like social activities, interests, and opinions. So if you're trying to target musicians or sports enthusiasts, it would be lifestyle segmentation, which is part of the psychographic segmentation that you'd be using. You can also get more individual needs groups that are very specific to certain industries. These tend to be represented by individual statements like parents that want to save time in shopping for food. And this would have been a clear segment for supermarkets offering online delivery before COVID. But since COVID, online food shopping has become far more mainstream, so this need group would no longer be as defined. And then there's psychographic segmentation, which also includes personality. And we use blanket terms like
compulsive, gregarious, authoritarian, and ambitious.
But behavioural variables are so much more readily available with the rise of digital analytics and tracking. But these include things like occasions, like regular, special, or one-off. Benefits, so whether somebody is more likely to be drawn to quality, service, economy, convenience, or speed. User status, like whether somebody is a non-user, or more commonly we would say that they've used a guest checkout, or they might be an ex-user. Again, I'd probably more commonly say that this is a lapsed customer, or a potential user, a first-time user. I'd probably call them a new customer or a regular user. Within regular user, you would get user rates, so light users, medium users, and heavy users. You look at loyalty, and this would scale from none, medium, strong, and absolute loyalty. Then you get readiness stage, which very much links to the sales funnel or the marketing funnel, if you know anything about that. But that would include unaware, aware, informed, interested, desirous, intending to buy. And then we also get things like attitude toward the products, like enthusiastics, positive, indifferent, negative, hostile.
Hi, how was your day? And I think, fuck off. What are you talking about? How was my day? My day has got absolutely nothing to do with you.
And thankfully, this takes us out of this huge list of variables. But hopefully that helps a little bit. It's just one of those things that I think we all know, but it doesn't hurt to look back through it again just to refresh it in our heads. So earlier I said that we'd come back round to talk about some of those psychographic groups, because I think that's where people can get a little bit lost when trying to understand the practical application of that variable. So again, I'm unapologetically going to use Facebook as an example. But when you're building an advert on Facebook, you're led through the process of audience creation, and of course you can start with things like geographical and demographic variables. So you might say that you're targeting 20 to 40 year old females living in London, but that is still going to be a huge audience. And if you're selling a specific product, it's quite likely they're going to be showing your advert to way more people than is actually relevant.
That's the news. And Bob, just confirming the ground is now good to see. Oh, you've been joined by a beautiful lady.
No, it's a man actually, Derek.
Who's it?
So at this stage, let's say that we're selling a skincare product. So we now need to add more specific targeting into Facebook to try and narrow down our audience. And the first thing that Facebook offers here is along the lines of behavioural, because Facebook knows which people have a tendency to click on adverts and actually buy something. So we can say that this kind of verges on a psychographic variable, because if you remember, one of the psychographic elements was compulsive. So a tendency to click on an advert and buy something could be considered as compulsive. But we can further narrow that by activating the in-market audience, which again is behavioural and possibly a little bit psychographic as well. But an in-market audience is basically saying that someone is in the market to buy a specific product at that time because of their behaviour online. So they're searching for a lot of skincare products at the time or going on the websites and browsing. So they're in the market for that genre of product. So with this example, you can see that we've used the tools available on Facebook advertising, now known as Meta advertising, to target a specific profile of customer. Does that make sense?
You kind of rambled there, but I get the picture. With all these things that you are talking about, targeting people using all this data, what's the deal with privacy? Like, is all of this legal?
That's actually a really good question. It almost seems a little bit contrived. But, you know, don't look a gift horse in the mouth, etc. So, yeah, I'm going to cover that here. Surface level, though, you know.
One more time.
So GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, is a law enacted by the European Union and the UK to protect the privacy and personal data of individuals. The GDPR ruling sets out types of data that can be held and also specifies special category data that fall under stricter guidelines. And you can only process these types of data under special conditions. So when you're creating your market segments, if you're thinking of using any of the following: racial or ethnic origin, political opinions, religious or philosophical beliefs, trade union membership, genetic data, biometric data, data concerning health, data concerning a person's sex life or sexual orientation, you'll need a very good reason to be processing that kind of data. So be warned.
It feels like a bit of a price to pay for a bit of honey.
So then, when we're talking about the behavioural elements, it's an area that there have been a lot of changes around. They're constantly evolving. And I kind of want to future-proof this episode by being quite unspecific, because privacy concerns are growing. Snap decisions are being made by companies like Google, Apple and Facebook that are having profound implications on how marketers can track user activity. The EU, the UK and the wider American and state-specific governing bodies are all kind of aligned, but also vary in their specific approach to tracking. But most areas require company websites to obtain clear consent from users before placing any non-essential cookies or tracking technologies on their devices, and also require granular control of consent to different cookies. They also require easy withdrawal of consent, and this includes things like emails offering clear and easy unsubscribes. There's demand for increased transparency from companies about how data is used, and cookie walls, which is not as nice as it sounds, is being cracked down on. So cookie walls is where you actually can't use a website without accepting the cookies. So this will put some sort of strain on website development. So before launching into segmentation, it's probably worth having a look at the relevant guidance for data processing in the geographical regions that you're intending to work with. Right, I feel like we've gone off a little bit again. So let's refocus a little bit on the sub-stages within the stage of marketing segmentation. And these were to firstly identify bases for segmenting the market, and secondly to develop segment profiles. When you develop the segment that you're going to market yourself to, you need to figure out how to target them. And we've already established that this involves research. Obviously, because companies and consumers and variables for segmentation are so varied, there's no single way to segment the market. So from the marketer's perspective, it's really about finding the best way to break down the market that will lead to effective marketing communications. Or it might influence other decisions. Like, say you're a key decision maker in a supermarket, would you stock the same range of haggis in Scotland that you would stock in the south of England? I'd imagine not. Or perhaps say that you knew that there was a big expat community in the region of one of your shops. Clearly you would consider offering products that would be desirable for that market. Well, in the 1990s, naan breads moved from being a niche category into the mass market in supermarkets because they were originally being sold in supermarkets close to areas where Indian origin immigrants lived, but they appealed to the wider population, so they became mainstream. And then on the higher levels of supermarkets, they have to decide what type of store is needed for geographical regions. This will be a launch of a superstore or one of those smaller corner shops type of offering, or a local store. So getting back to trying to identify bases for segmenting the market, demographic segmentation is probably the easiest and most generic form of segmentation. I would say that there's quite a few pitfalls that you could fall into if you're just using demographic segmentation. I mean, not every 70-year-old is going to be into the same type of thing. Some are in wheelchairs, some are very active and still play sports regularly. Some couples in their mid-40s are just starting their families, where some have children that are about to go to university. So we need to mix it up and use a few different elements when building a segment profile. Gender is becoming an increasingly complex area, and we're seeing more and more stories these days of companies landing themselves in hot water due to certain insensitivities when using gender-targeted products. I'm not going to name them, but a music instrument manufacturer made a pink synthesizer with an inbuilt makeup mirror, which was specifically targeted for female musicians. That didn't go down well.
Yeah, that seems a bit tone deaf.
Yeah, very funny. I love a pun. For premium products, there's obviously going to be some form of segmentation in line with income. This is most relevant when we're talking about products like cars, boats, clothing, cosmetics, financial services, and travel. and there's a clear link between income and the psychographic element of social class and lifestyle. When it comes to luxury, there's also a side to consider, which is the increase in focus on service. And that's where things like loyalty programs and award programs come in, and you see convenience elements added, where customers spend over a certain amount and tend to get things like free delivery, complimentary drinks, or access to lounges when it comes to things like flyer clubs of airlines. Shops like Harrods offer personal shoppers and access to armchairs with free tea being brought to you by a personal attendant if you spend over 10 grand a year.
Would you apologise for your comment?
Will you have a cup of tea?
Will you apologise for your comment?
Would you like a cup of tea?
Yeah, sure.
Keep going. Have a cup of tea.
Thank you.
Or American Express are another example of a company that offers different tiers to different customers based on income. Or, more accurately, disposable income, because it's about how much they're spending, not how much they're earning. But the reason that companies do this is because the most affluent customers tend to be the most profitable. If they weren't, they simply wouldn't do it. So if you take a company like Aldi or Lidl, it would make no sense to add this sort of offering into their strategy because it's simply not their target market and it wouldn't generate any sales to justify it. And their offering isn't tailored towards the audience, so there's some nuance here. I think when you build these audiences, you have to be thinking along the lines of a Venn diagram, which is those circles that cross over. So your target segment would be people that fit into multiple wider categories. But it's by specifying that the customers you're targeting have to fit into all categories that you start to refine your audience. Behavioural segmentation tends to divide customers into groups based on their knowledge, attitudes, or uses or responses to a product. And like I said, more recently, that utilises digital information based on how people have acted online. Behavioural segmentation is becoming the first port of call really now for most marketers because it's usually more effective than demographical segments. We have so much more information now about how consumers behave online, which gives a much clearer indication of how they would like to buy products. So like I said, it's about combining these different attributes to design a customer profile. There are some things to think about when it comes to certain occasions like Mother's Day and Father's Day because we're not talking about a repeat purchase. It's a one-off. So it's harder to rely on behavioural variables. But geographically, some countries celebrate Mother's and Father's Day on different days. And in Catholic countries, christenings are some of the most important days of the year. So campaigns around christening gifts may be much more effective there. One type of behavioural segmentation that's really interesting is segmenting by benefit sought. And one of the reasons I find this interesting is because if you're talking about a product, certain people will value one set of benefits ahead of another. And I've said about this in previous episodes, but I've related this to paper. But paper for businesses, like a printer, has different characteristics that will appeal in different ways to different potential customers. So the same paper may appeal to a printer because they have a Hewlett-Packard printer that has been proven to work very well on that paper, whereas another printer may like that paper because it has a certain shade of whiteness. Another printer may like that paper because it runs really well through the converting machinery they have when it comes to die cutting. And another printer may like that paper because it has a certain recycled content. It's the same paper, but it offers different benefits, and different customers will buy that paper for a specific need. So from a marketing standpoint, you need to understand your consumers and make sure that you're communicating these benefits to the right people, because the printer that wants a paper with high recycled content, maybe because they're publishing for Lush or another eco-conscious customer, doesn't care that it performs well on a Hewlett-Packard printer because they're probably using Heidelberg or something like that. And the printer that needs a high whiteness doesn't necessarily care about the recycled content. Hopefully you get the picture here.
Yeah, boy.
The other thing to consider is that if we're talking about existing customers for a company, with a decent CRM, which is a customer resource management database, marketers can segment the customer base, giving them a status of whether they're current customers, lapsed customers, or customers that have got stuck in the sales pipeline somewhere. So within current customers, you could have various usage rates and levels of customers that will spend varying amount of money by month or by week or even by year, however you look at it. And that kind of goes hand in hand with loyalty. So whether the customer strictly buys from you, which we would call a completely loyal customer, or they may be partially loyal and you may be part of their evoked set. I'll come back to the evoked set another time in another episode, but it basically means the set of things that a customer would consider buying. Apple is usually used as a good example for the case of customers that are completely loyal to a brand. And I suppose I do fall into that category. I've got an iPhone, I've got a MacBook, I have an iPad, and I even have an old MacBook Pro that I can't bear to throw out because it served me so well and I've spent so much money on it. If anyone has any ideas of what I should do with that, just let me know, because I have no idea. But people like Gary Armstrong in his marketing books talk about the cult of the Mac, populated by Macolites, also known as Mac Zealots. Well, that's a clear segment. There tends to be a really strong audience for Mac in the creative industries. Mac performs really well for music production, design, and all that kind of stuff. So that's another clear segment. And personally, I find that the connectivity of Macs is really good. So usually you just plug something in and it works. You don't have to bother with drivers and all that kind of stuff. But in my experience, I think that's seen as a drawback for IT professionals, that you can't code as much or something like that. I don't know. Maybe they work so well, they're worried about being out of a job. So IT people are probably not going to be the target audience. But that's also good to know when building our segment, because that's who we're going to exclude. I don't really know. I'm taking educated guesses at all of this. But my point is that you can get people who are very anti-Mac. So when you're segmenting an audience, you need to take that into consideration. Imagine if you're developing an app and you prioritize functionality on Apple devices, but the majority of your target market fit into the anti-Mac category and your app doesn't perform as well on Android and Google devices. You've kind of shot yourself in the foot there before you've even got going. Something that this is touching on is also culture and subculture in terms of segmentation. Sometimes I think this is easier to define than other times. There are very clear subcultures when it comes to music, and we can link clear subcultures with genres. Sometimes I think this is easier to define than other times. There are very clear subcultures when it comes to music, and we can link clear subcultures with genres, which can make a really nice predefined segment. To use an extreme example, Norwegian black metal is a distinct musical genre which has a distinct linked subculture. This subculture clearly love the music so much that they have immersed themselves in the culture, which means they're obvious targets for Norwegian black metal music. But they're also good targets for other certain types of clothing, like generally black combat trousers, but more specifically black gothic wedding dresses. And they're also quite partial to a bit of church burning, so they're a good target for Molotov cocktails. I probably shouldn't have picked Norwegian black metal as an example, because it's actually a very complex topic. Academically, we'd probably define that group as a counterculture, as in a culture that's positioned opposed to the mainstream, which is something we also call a disassociative group, because they don't want to be associated with the mainstream. So let's move away from that complex group to a more easily understood group, which would be around cultural segmentation. So that would be when you're marketing to ethnic minorities within a country. And we previously had an example of that with supermarkets targeting Indian populations with naan breads. But as you can imagine, if you're a supermarket or a shop and you could bring foods from the country of origin to those people, then you might have a predefined target market there. But really, just in closing, we're talking at this stage about building that profile within segmentation so that you can move to targeting. But marketers rarely limit segmentation to a small amount of variables. You'll try and hone your profile to be as relevant as possible, using what we call multivariable segmentation. There are information services businesses out there that aim to help hone your segmentation, such as Claritas, Experion, Axiom, MapInfo, and there's loads more. But they link census and transaction data with consumer lifestyle patterns to be able to segment markets down to postcodes, streets, and even households. You could also use a company like CensusWide to conduct a research project to help you define your segment.
CensusWide.
CensusWide. If we can't have good energy here, that's a bad thing.
CensusWide.
So yeah, you have a lot of choices here, including doing your own research, using a research company like CensusWide, or using one of the information services businesses that I mentioned. In my opinion, you can't beat specific research carried out for your specific target audience. But going back to the information services platforms, I had a look at a few of them, and the one that stuck out for me was the Mosaic Customer Classification System, and it's quite mind-blowing, really. I really like the visuals that they offer. You can put all sorts of demographic factors in, as well as behavioural and lifestyle factors, and it's country specific. They seem to get some of the nuances between different countries. In the UK, as an example, they have 66 unique lifestyle types, which they split into 15 lifestyle groups. But don't quote me on that, because they seem to update the platform quite often, so that number may change. I love some of the names that they give the groups, like Corporate Chieftains. That's in Group A at the top of the segmentation groups. And Mosaic provide information like that this group accounts for 9.62% of households, but the Corporate Chieftains account for 1.12% of households. So if you're using this software to create your segment profile, you know at that stage what the overall target group sizing is going to be. If you want to put that into numbers, you can divide the overall population in the region that you're targeting and take 1.12% of that population, and you could say that's the number that you're targeting. If you're working in a B2B industry, there's even more options. Experian have a database of over 5 million British businesses. I will say, though, Experian license fees range anywhere from $5,000 up to $75,000 a year, depending on your business size and needs. So you might find that a bespoke research project will work out more detailed and more cost-effective. It really depends on your project. But there are all sorts of other segmentation tools that you can use if you build up a picture of your ideal customer in a less specific way, and then are looking to apply that to the type of marketing that you're using. You might have a customer profile built up in a more descriptive way that you can then translate into data. So that when you actually go to use a platform like Meta Ads, you can translate this ideal customer into the settings that are available on the platform. If you're doing a multi-channel marketing campaign and you have some form of direct marketing or postal element, you have to translate that customer profile into the settings available through the Royal Mail targeting platform or whatever other program you might use. And sometimes it pays to be more specific, and sometimes it pays to have a more top-level or generic profile in mind. I feel like you need to be a bit careful, because you can also add information to a segment profile that really doesn't offer any benefit, like segmenting your audience by blonde and brunette hair. It's very relevant if you're selling a hair dye, but not relevant at all if you're selling coffee. I think, anyway. So there are some pointers generally agreed upon for creating a segment, and these include... Number one, segments should be measurable. Number two, the segment should be accessible. Number three, the segment should be substantial. Number four, the segment should be differentiable. And number five, the segment should be actionable. Just to reiterate, segments should be measurable, accessible, substantial, differentiable, and actionable. Onwards to targeting. Okay, picture this. You're an elite sniper, perched on a rooftop with your target in sight, a high-value individual who's been wreaking havoc in your world. Now, to get here, you didn't just grab your rifle and sharp at some random spot. No, you had to do your homework first, right? Step one.
Fight!
Segmentation.
Perfect.
You scoured the city, figuring out which districts were most likely to have your target. They don't just hang out anywhere, after all. You sifted through crowds, picking out the places where the VIPs congregate, weeding out the noise, until you could zero in on a few select neighbourhoods where you knew your high-value target frequents. Step 2.
Panic boom!
Targeting. Now that you've narrowed it down to a couple of places, you start to gather intel. Where does this person show up? What's their routine? And lo and behold, you discover that every Tuesday at 3 p.m. sharp, this person takes a leisurely stroll down Maple Street to get their macchiato from Deborah's coffee shop. You know where they're going. You know when they'll be there. That's when you know this is your mark. Step 3.
Hadouken!
And yes, I'm aware that this is skipping way ahead, but bear with me for the sake of completion. We're at positioning. It's time to find the best vantage point. You can't just set up anywhere. You need the perfect spot across the street, maybe behind the world's best donut sign, where you've got a clear line of sight, but they are still well hidden. You know that setting up on top of the coffee shop will be way too obvious. It's about finding that sweet spot where you've got the best chance of making the shot without your target ever knowing you were there.
You win!
So, you can't start targeting people without segmentation, and we can't get to the final step of actually positioning yourself as a sniper, let's say, or choosing where to place a really well-positioned billboard advert without the process of targeting. Just like a sniper, your mission is to be strategic. You need to understand your target's behaviours, needs, and routines before knowing that you've positioned yourself in the right place at the right time with the perfect message, so that when you pull the trigger, it's a bullseye. Because at the end of the day, whether you're taking out a high-value target or landing a high-value customer, it's about planning, precision, and pulling the trigger at the exact right moment.
This analogy is getting old, I'm afraid.
What are you afraid of?
Any more shit analogies.
Okay, maybe that is a bit of a shit analogy. But if you can take anything away from it, I hope it's that targeting is about understanding the segment and their behaviour so that you can position the product or brand using the right language and marketing communication that will appeal to them. Again, talking about targeting, it might be a good idea to revisit the Goldilocks and the Three Bears analogy.
Oh bloody hellfire, this again?
I thought I proved that this was a good analogy.
Okay.
That's what I thought. If we have our three target audiences, Papa Bear, Mama Bear, and Baby Bear, and we've used the process of segmentation to create segment profiles for each of these audiences, we can now actively target each audience with the relevant products. It's probably worth reiterating the point that was made earlier about research, because if you don't have research about your segments and you start targeting consumers, you could get this very wrong. So we know from the folktale that Goldilocks likes Baby Bear's porridge, chair, and bed. We got there through trial and error, which in marketing can be expensive. You most likely don't have the resources to make that many errors in targeting. But if we go back to the start of the tale, how would we know which porridge, chair, and bed to target Goldilocks with without knowing a little bit more about her? Knowing about Goldilocks, and by extension knowing about our segment, goes hand in hand with knowing those categories of data: demographic, geographic, psychographic, and behavioural. And to also call back to that definition we looked at in the definition section,
a target market is a group of customers with shared demographics who have been identified as the most likely buyers of a company's product or service. Identifying the target market is important in the development and implementation of a successful marketing plan for any new product. The target market also can inform a product's specifications, packaging, and distribution.
So based on that, targeting is a transient stage then. Targeting is furthering segmentation so that we can actually do something with the information gleaned in the segmentation stage. And at this stage, we may have a broad segment or a very narrow segment. There's a lot of discussion between marketing academics about the narrowest form of segment. And you hear people refer to individual marketing or a segment of one or one-to-one marketing. In the context of targeting, we're talking about using the information that is available to us in segmentation to be able to offer a tailored message within positioning that is so specific it's only relevant to one person. I struggle with this a segment of one concept a little bit, to be honest, because it's not that I don't understand it, I totally get it. But let's say we're talking about email marketing or even a Facebook advert. What we're talking about here is tailoring a message to be very specific to an individual. But to target that individual for an email, they have to belong to a database, which in itself is a wider form of segment, right?
Exactly.
Or for a Facebook advert, the message may be tailored using specific information available to an advertiser. But what we're not doing is specifying each individual segment of one, because that's a completely unrealistic task unless you're talking about some form of B2B marketing campaign where each individual target may be worth millions. And you're not designing each individual piece of marketing for each of those individual people.
Yeah, dude.
What you're actually doing is connecting a bunch of multivariates within your segment with a bunch of personalizations available in your chosen medium, whether that be an email platform or social media ad.
That's why it's just a concept.
Yeah, exactly.
Got ya.
A concept, not necessarily a reality. I'm also very keen to make sure that I point out that targeting is rarely focused around demographic and geographic characteristics. Sure, back in the old days, this was definitely the case. But even as far back as the 50s, marketing started to change and become more emotionally driven. Just watch Mad Men. And it's because of this that the psychographic and behavioural elements of audience segmentation and targeting become really important. This focus only grew into the late 80s and into the early 2000s. And now, much of the segmentation that defines the success of campaigns is emotionally led. Concepts such as emotional marketing, experiential marketing, and brand equity grew in that period of about 20 years from the 80s to the early 2000s, and brand management changed with it. So if you're looking to work on your positioning, make sure you take into account the emotional messaging that you're going to use for your campaign. And make sure you have an understanding of your target segment's likely perception of that messaging. Without trying to jump ahead to positioning, one example of targeting a segment with emotionally compelling marketing can be seen in the success that Volvo had in planting the idea in the mind of car-buying parents that Volvo offered the most safety of any car for their family.
Volvo, a car you can believe in.
So to achieve the end game of successfully positioning Volvo in this way, you can easily connect parents within a family who are looking to buy a car with the perceived prioritisation of safety in the process of buying a car. If you want to delve into the psychology, you can bring in the legendary Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs and say that by focusing on safety over any other potential USP of the car to this group, all other unique selling points seem less important. Safety is on tier 2 of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and only the physiological needs of air, water, food, shelter, sleep, clothing, and reproduction are seen as more important. But because Volvo bring in safety and family, they're targeting a wider base of needs, from safety right through love and belonging, but arguably even self-esteem and self-actualization to an extent. But by focusing on one of the most basic needs for a parent, the hope is that anything else is more aspirational in the process of selecting a car, so more hedonistic and less important. It could even make parental car buyers feel stupid for choosing anything else, shaming them into thinking that they're a bad parent if they don't get a Volvo. What would the other parents say in the school car park?
Too much, Will. Too much.
Well, maybe that is too much. But this kind of social marketing works. Volvo absolutely nailed their targeting, which meant they could nail their positioning as well. By then depicting a family in one of their cars being kept extremely safe, they could tap into the extremely powerful parental emotions. Again, calling back to a previous episode, I talked quite a lot about the emotional aspects of marketing in my marketing strategy episode. So if you can follow Volvo's example, you might be able to tap into the emotional drivers for the products and services that you're marketing. Looping back to the wider context of positioning, the process of marketing segmentation should have revealed the company's market segment opportunities, so that moving into the process of targeting, you can evaluate the various segments and decide how many and which segments you can serve best. So in that sense, targeting fits seamlessly with segmentation, and it's really part of the process of refining segmentation. But that's just for context, really. In their book, Principles of Marketing, Philip Kotler and Gary Armstrong state that there are three primary factors to evaluate market segments by. Help me out here, mate. What are they?
1. Segment size and growth. 2. Segment structural attractiveness. 3. Company objectives and resources.
That's correct. But I would say that this is all relative. And I think that there are so many different nuances and complication that it's really up to you as a marketer to discern and evaluate segments and the situational analysis of the company so that you can evaluate those three areas. I'd like to clarify this a little bit though. So those three factors, which are segment size and growth, segment structural attractiveness, and company objectives and resources, are all quite generic. I'd like to think that segment size and growth is fairly self-explanatory, and company objectives and resources should be fairly well understood to those working for that company. But there's a lot around the segment structural attractiveness that needs to be understood. So I would suggest that a PESTEL analysis would be a good port of call here, looking at political, economic, social, environmental, and legal factors that might help inform as to whether there are any macro factors that could influence whether the segment is worth targeting or not. And it would probably be worth carrying out a more detailed competitor analysis at this stage too. I'm flipping around a lot, but having mentioned families, I do want to give a nod to the complexities of targeting children.
Oh, won't somebody please think of the children?
Because when you're marketing a product to kids, you're not necessarily marketing direct to the buyer. In this instance, what you're actually doing is creating demand with your target audience, creating what we call pester power, for that child to pester their parent to buy a product. But usually, this approach is two-pronged, because you also need to market to the parent. So to target these segments, you need some quite complex analysis to see what media both the children and parent are interacting with, in order to place the most effective adverts or product placement or public relations messaging or whatever else you might plan to drive the parent and child to make the purchase. Again, and I'm sorry to flip quickly to positioning, but you might position a toy to a child in terms of how fun it is to play with, whereas you would position a toy to the parent more for its educational benefits. We can also see a similar relationship when you're selling B2B products or services that involves more than one decision maker. When I worked in the paper industry, we had to consider three parties that influenced the paper specification: printers, designers, and then corporate end users. The printers buy the paper on behalf of the end user corporate, but the designer incorporates the paper spec into their designs, and the printers vet that the paper works for their printer. This goes back to what I was saying before about selling the same product in different ways. The end user and designer may be more focused on the aesthetics of the paper, but the printer will also be worried about how well that paper performs on the machine. The end user and printer will be more driven on a cost basis, whereas this isn't of great importance to the designer in most cases. And each of these targets will read their own respective media. And this brings me on to talk about media selection. So media selection is a really important part of targeting. Obviously, with a given segment in mind, it's really important to choose the right media and communication channels to communicate to the right target segment. I'm going to do a future episode on the PESO model, which covers all the different media channels, but it goes without saying that you have to pick the right mix of channels for your chosen audience. Now, if that sounds a lot like positioning, it's because it is. But remember that targeting is transient. It's about getting from segmentation to positioning, so the lines are blurred. When choosing communication channels, it's no good focusing your campaign on social media if your target audience doesn't use social media. You also need to select the right media so that you can cover the full marketing funnel. And what I mean by this is you need to find the right communication channels to initially reach customers, then engage with them, and then convert them into becoming customers. And then you have to have ways to keep them loyal and coming back for more. Again, this harks back to the episode I did on marketing strategy. If you haven't nailed your segmentation, media selection within targeting is going to be a lot of guesswork, and probably along the lines of mass marketing. And over 30 years ago, Philip Kotler published a quote saying,
"Mass marketing is putting the product in the market and going to mass on Sunday and praying someone buys it."
And I love that quote because I wholeheartedly agree. Let me throw my own quote into the mix though. And that is that mass marketing is based on averages. The average consumer wants this, that, or the other. But if you base everything on averages, you'll end up with a particularly average campaign or offering. If you want to quote me on that, be my guest, but a reference would be nice. And just finally, before we move on to positioning, company resources will play a massive part to know how many segments a company can afford to target. Companies with wider budgets can afford to target wider segments with bigger campaigns, but companies that have limited resources usually are better off targeting more refined segments with smaller campaigns. Then product lifecycle also comes into play with targeting, because we've all heard of those different lifecycle segments, such as, help me out here, mate.
Innovators, early adopters, early majority, late majority, laggards.
These lifecycle segments are usually used in terms of technology, but they are also very clear segments that can be targeted. When it comes to targeting using platforms, I've talked a lot about the Facebook or Meta advertising platform on my podcast, but you can see a lot of innovation on email platforms offering dynamic segmentation. and these options allow you to target people within the segment based on their engagement. I think this is a great feature, and platforms like Campaign Monitor give them names like
active, engaged, unengaged, dormant, zombies, and ghosts.
Thanks, mate. But going back to products, product variability is yet another consideration, because if you have a product that has lots of different variants, you might find that you can target different segments with different variants. And a great example of that would be colour. I need to tread very carefully here, and I know that I'll probably get shot down in flames, but you could possibly say that a pink product variant would appeal to a female audience.
Sexist pink.
Okay. I'm just trying to illustrate my point. Let's move swiftly on to positioning. So I'm going to ask you to bear with me again as I pull you back into the Goldilocks analogy one last time.
No comment.
So we're going to revisit Goldilocks because with targeting, I suggested that without the right research, targeting could be way off. And the exact same thing applies for positioning. That's because positioning is about knowing your segment and actively communicating the relevance of your products and services to your target markets. So for Baby Bear's Porridge, which we know is Goldilocks' favourite because it's neither too hot nor too cold, so if we were trying to position the porridge for Goldilocks, we would say,
craving the perfect porridge. Try Baby Bear's. It's not too hot, not too cold. Just right. Satisfy your taste with a bowl that's made for you.
When it comes to the chair, we know that Papa Bear's chair was too big and hard. Mama Bear's chair was too soft. But Baby Bear's little chair was perfect. But let's just gloss over the fact that the chair then breaks because it wasn't big enough for her. And we would maybe position the chair like,
tired of chairs that are too big and hard, but sick of overly soft medium chairs? You need a Baby Bear chair, soft, but not too soft, and perfectly formed. And for some reason, perfect for young girls with golden hair. Does this sound like you? Grab yourself a Baby Bear chair while stocks last.
Sorry, I don't know what that voice was. And I probably added a little bit too much tenuous stuff in there. But again, you get the picture. From Goldilocks' perspective, that would feel very relevant as an advert. And I'm sure at this stage you get the picture, but just for the sake of completion, just like the chairs, Papa Bear's bed was too hard, Mama's bed was too soft, but Baby Bear's was just right. So the advert would go something like,
Goldilocks, just bloody buy a Baby Bear bed, won't you?
And obviously a joke by saying that, but it does bring in a few relevant elements. And the first is market research. So the first point is that if we consider for some reason we are a company that sells porridge, chairs and beds, and for each of these products we have three options, the Papa model, the Mama model and the Baby model, it's likely that with a good database we can analyse sales trends and look at what beds and chairs customers of Baby Bear's Porridge buy. And for the sake of simplicity, if we can see that customers that buy Baby Bear Porridge predominantly buy Baby Bear's chairs and Baby Bear's beds, we can predict that a customer that buys a Baby Bear porridge and Baby Bear chair will be best suited to a Baby Bear's bed. Still with me? So, using our database, we can predict the most relevant products for a customer and actively promote that product for them. Then secondly, so a similar way of understanding this, but perhaps a less proactive way from a company point of view, is brand loyalty. And it doesn't really matter if Papa, Mama and Baby are all different companies or different ranges within the company's offering. Because if you think about companies like Coca-Cola, they have hundreds of sub-brands. But say that for each audience, they have brand loyalty to one of the three brands, Papa, Mama or Baby. by giving them a consistently positive experience with that brand, and you could even say by them having a negative experience with other brands, just like Goldilocks did with the Mama and Papa porridge and chairs, and with the right branding to display each bed as belonging to that brand of Mama, Papa and Baby, the consumer, in this case Goldilocks, would be much likely to choose the most relevant product first time, resulting in better sales for Baby Bear beds with a higher customer satisfaction due to a better overall product experience. Number three would be individual targeting. So this is the last point really, and it's probably less clear. But going back to that sore point for me of an audience of one, when talking about an audience of one, I mentioned multivariates and connecting them with personalizations. So by following this concept, we can create a customized experience for consumers using the information that we've been utilizing to build our segments in the first place. So again, demographic, geographic, psychographic, and behavioral. So we need to build campaigns that take all of these elements into consideration to both communicate and suggest products to consumers in the most relevant way possible. And like I said, this point is probably harder to illustrate, but if I pick one medium such as emails, you could think about utilizing your database and programming all sorts of different variants to an email to make it extremely relevant. So this might take geographical elements into consideration, suggesting the local retailers that sell Baby Bear porridge, Baby Bear chairs and Baby Bear beds. The imagery may be tailored to each demographic, showing images of people closer to the demographic of each customer. So if we know that they're in their early 20s, we show them imagery of people in their early 20s enjoying the products. But if they're in their late 60s, then we use imagery of people in their late 60s enjoying the products. Again, this just increases relevance. We might have some behavioural information, such as we know that they have purchased Baby Bear porridge in the past, so we position Baby Bear chairs and Baby Bear beds as having some sort of synergy with the porridge. And finally, on the psychographic side, we may know that they engage with a lot of content around ethics. So we make it very clear that as a company, we're against animal testing, and no bears were harmed in the making of our porridge, chairs and beds.
I actually like that joke, good one. Not.
But basically, when it comes to positioning, we have to think about the company, product or service in the context of the competitive space that it occupies in its market. And this is defined in terms of attributes that actually matter to the target market. So, if you can try and visualize this, sometimes you can kind of think of a potential USP in a semantic scale. And the semantic scale might be a rating of 1 to 10, with 1 being extremely cold porridge and 10 being extremely hot porridge. If we can then plot temperature along that scale, we can define the ideal number for each of these audiences. So say daddy porridge is a 9 out of 10, then mummy porridge is a 5 out of 10, and baby bear porridge is 2 out of 10. Then we have a target value that we know the audience has a preference for, and we know that that product has the characteristics that we can highlight to a potential customer that we know will see that as ideal. Again, relevance. So obviously temperature is just one of the product characteristics, and temperature is easy to recreate for other brands, so it's unlikely to be a USP. But other things like portion size, sweetness, or even saltiness, the colour of the porridge, the colour of the bowl, the smell, etc, etc, you could even see what people think is the trendiest porridge. All of these characteristics can be plotted on semantic scales. Then you know what your target segment wants. You can either develop products that will be closer to what the customer wants, or potentially focus on the elements that you perform best in for that segment. But whatever you end up doing, it's led by research, and it's a purposeful attempt to position the product for the target consumer. There are some common characteristics or top-level dimensions to consider here, and these are quite generally thought to be quality, price, design, value-added service, and then performance. But this is such a complex area, I'm not going to list off everything. But of course, you have to think about things like price, and if you're looking at a business rather than a single product, you have to think about things like a range of products and different merchandising strategies. You get the picture, I'm sure. I've laboured the Goldilocks analogy to death, so we'll put that to bed now. Again, excuse the pun.
You proved your point, Wilbo. But I have to say, I'm glad to see the back of those bears, and I'm not a fan of Goldilocks. She's a thieving little shitbug.
Whoa, okay. So, as excruciating as that may have been, I do think it provides a really good framework to understand STP. So to put all of that in academic terms, marketing positioning involves understanding customer needs, defining a unique selling point, a value proposition, and communicating with target audiences. Positioning is about what the company wants to be known for and remembered for, and that's not always exclusive. Sometimes a company can cater to several different segments, but sometimes that's not possible, especially if the brand is trying to be ultra-premium for an affluent segment, but then ultra-affordable for a low-income segment. So then it's worth mentioning the 7 Ps. A company's differentiation should be reflected in its marketing mix. So as a part of positioning, it's really important to pick the right channels to communicate the brand's message. And a reminder of those dastardly 7 Ps.
1.
Product.
2.
Price.
3.
Place.
4.
Promotion.
5.
People.
6.
Process.
7.
Physical evidence.
Sonic boom!
These might help you to make sure that you're covering all of the various considerations for campaign planning. Putting them into practice, a potential proprietor might place its product in particular parlours and promote it in precise placements in media, pertaining to provoke the preoccupation of its predefined potential purchaser.
Potentially, overpronunciation of peas there pillium poo pladi prickhead pillok pa 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 pehpe pupi.
Oops, I think I broke mate. All the peas. But I'm not going to go into this in the full depth that I could because it would be tedious and I would be here forever. It's already a long episode. But every single area here is so important and should be considered as part of the marketing strategy. Creativity wouldn't go amiss here, by the way.
I'm being creative? Now, if you'll excuse me, I still have some work to do.
But in terms of positioning, one of the considerations we have to make is competitive advantage. Because this is the crux of connecting our unique selling point or our customer proposition with the customers that will value these points the most. It's only by doing this that we'll actually get a competitive advantage over our competitors. It's like my earlier example about positioning the same paper to different people. It might be that we just need to focus on the specific product characteristic that we know a customer group will highly value. Again, with a sniper analogy, we know that with a particular position,
beep, 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 beep,
which I think I said was on the rooftop by the donut sign, that we will be in the perfect place for our primary target. But it's also possible that with the same position, we might be able to get a few other fairly high value targets as well. It basically comes down to prioritization. So from a marketing sense, we might know that there are 3 segments that all value the same key features. It's just that they value them in a different order. So we make the call with our marketing department that it's more economic to target all 3 segments with the same campaign, but we prioritise the most valuable targets order of prioritisation, if that makes sense. But customers can be overloaded with information, which is why it's important to communicate effectively and focus on relevance. So although it doesn't seem like a big deal about the order in which you might prioritise certain elements in a marketing campaign, please trust me when I say it absolutely does matter. This isn't something you want to leave to chance, especially when you're spending a lot of money on the campaign. Some of the tools that you could use for positioning include positioning maps or outlining a strategy, which I've covered a lot in the strategy episode. In academia, there's also a bit of an outline of how to decide which differences to promote to choose the right competitive advantage. And these are 1, important, 2, distinctive, 3, superior, 4, communicable, 5, preemptive, 6, affordable, and 7, profitable. And I don't know whether it ended up being 7, but that just seems to keep happening with me and my considerations like that.
Stop crying, it won't do any good. And anyway, you have a lot of work to do, starting right now.
Okay, well, thanks for sticking with me so far. It's a tough topic when there's no visuals. A picture says 1,000 words, and according to my word count, I've said roughly 14,000 words already. But here are a few more needed to bring this to a close.
Try to relax your anus.
But finally, I want to talk about positioning statements. It's something that could be worth working on to create a point of reference for your positioning. The good news is there is a widely accepted formation of positioning statement. And when you read this, there will be a few blanks for you to fill in with information that you will have refined to this point. It's so much easier if you can read this, but obviously in a podcast, I can't write this down. So I'm going to tie in the wonderful mate to read out the blanks for me. Mate, are you okay now?
Yeah, sorry about that.
What happened?
Too many peace, mate.
All I'm saying is give peace a chance. Okay, here we go. So the positioning statement form goes like this. To
target segment and need.
Our
brand
is
concept
that
point of difference.
Confusing, right? Let me repeat that. To
target segment and need.
Our
brand
is
concept
that
point of difference.
So stealing Gary Armstrong's 2009 example, to
busy mobile professionals who need always to be in the loop.
Our
BlackBerry
is
a wireless connectivity solution
that
allows you to stay connected to data, people and resources while on the go, easily and reliably, more so than competing technologies.
And obviously that statement hasn't aged well, because just a year after this, BlackBerry's stock crashed, and by 2016 they'd stopped making devices, but you get the picture. And it's obviously crucial that once the position has been defined for a particular segment, we use all the right communication methods and channels to actively communicate the position to target customers. Again, defining the marketing mix and the tactical details of the positioning strategy. There's a real risk here if you come up with a fantastic strategy but then fail to deliver it, all this work is in vain. I guess this is really where the theoretical stuff that I've been talking about crosses into the practical application. And I'm not really going to cover that in this episode, because that's basically the whole job of a marketer. I feel like that can only come through practical experience and research, but it is something that can be enhanced by learning more general marketing concepts through things like the Marketing Made Clear podcast. Fingers crossed. Just finally, on the practical application of targeting through positioning, the process obviously started way back in segmentation, where campaign objectives led to the target audience selection, in which we selected the segments that we wanted to target within the campaign. Then, within the targeting stage, selecting the right media is of significant importance, and that was all based off research that was conducted and refined in the segmentation phase, the process of which takes us to positioning. Then, the creative development of the campaign takes place with a clear focus on the selected segments, which is a key part of positioning. And then finally, we get to response management, which is where we collect and then evaluate the effectiveness of the campaign. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. The completion of the STP process. Okay, just to completely close this episode over, we're going to look at some of the common questions around segmentation, targeting and positioning. I'll try and keep this fast. Give me some music and fire away, mate.
How many USPs should you promote?
There are different trains of thought on this, because some marketers think that companies should aggressively promote just a single benefit to the target market. Some of the older marketing leaders tend to say that a company should develop a single unique selling proposition for each brand and stick to it. With this, each brand should pick an attribute and sell itself as number one on the attribute so that customers actually remember it. I probably sit on a different train of thought with this. I feel that marketers should position brands on more than one differentiator, but potentially have a primary differentiator and a few other secondary differentiators or USPs. I could flip the question back to you and say, how many different USPs can the customer remember? The honest answer to this is sometimes customers can't remember any, so you shouldn't be trying to communicate too many here, and obviously with the caveat that I probably haven't considered every industry and every type of product and service, but I would say that you should keep this to less than 5 USPs. Additionally, I would say by this I mean 5 USPs per segment. You could use an unlimited number of USPs if you're targeting an unlimited number of segments, but I think that's more of a conceptual rather than practical kind of application.
How does brand relate to marketing positioning?
Brand and marketing position are tightly interwoven, like two sides of the same coin. Positioning defines where your brand fits in the market and in the minds of consumers, while the brand itself encompasses the unique identity, personality, and promise you're putting out to the world.
Can you give me an example of lots of different positions within a single market?
Yes, of course. I actually found a great example in the book Principles of Marketing by Francis Brassington and Stephen Petit for this. They used an example of soups, and it went something like this. Covent Garden and Baxter's soups are positioned as a dinner party starter. Cross and Blackwell's soups are positioned as a warming snack. Heinz whole soups are positioned as a meal replacement. Campbell's condensed soups are positioned as a recipe ingredient. Bachelor's cup of soups are positioned as an easy office lunch. Who knew that soups could be positioned in so many different ways? Next.
Are there any dangers to look out for when segmenting an audience?
Absolutely, of course. I think the main things to look out for are the poor definition and some of the things I've already mentioned, like overly breaking down the market when you can't actually treat one segment any different to another. Then you basically lost a bunch of time on superfluous activity. I suppose that you could decide that you want to cater for a segment by making a new product, and in that case you could also lose a lot of money by developing something that actually doesn't have any kind of demand, but that's just a general risk with new product development. So I've tried to focus on how to do segmentation properly to avoid some of these pitfalls, but yeah, there's always going to be risks.
What happens if you get your positioning wrong?
If you get your positioning wrong, then your products are unlikely to resonate with your target customers, so you'll need to reconsider your positioning, engaging in what is called repositioning. You might get your positioning wrong on the launch of a product, or the market might change over time, which means that the product is no longer as well positioned as it was. So developing technology, evolving competition, changing customer needs and wants, I mean, that positioning has to be constantly reviewed. Repositioning can be extremely costly, but often is a necessary exercise. This has gone drastically wrong in the past, and I've used a few examples of that. For instance, New Coke was a disaster in the sense that it fell flat on its face. You don't always need to completely reinvent the wheel, and often brands can just make minor adjustments to their positioning rather than having to make wholesale changes. This is still repositioning, just different levels of intensity.
Why is segmentation important?
Well, hopefully this was clear, but to reiterate, segmentation is important because it allows marketers to understand the diverse needs, preferences, and behaviours within a larger market. By grouping customers based on specific characteristics, companies can tailor their marketing strategies to be more relevant and effective, ultimately leading to better engagement and higher conversion rates.
Let's go.
How do you choose the right target market?
To choose the right target market, consider the segment's size, growth potential, profitability, and alignment with your company's resources and capabilities. You need to evaluate whether you can effectively reach the segment and whether the segment's needs match your product's features or brand values. Prioritizing segments where you can offer a distinct advantage or better serve customers than competitors can also guide your decision.
What is the difference between targeting and positioning?
So targeting is the process of selecting which market segments you want to focus on, while positioning is about creating a unique image and identity for your brand in the minds of targeted consumers. Targeting decides who you'll market to, and positioning decides how you'll communicate your brand's values to them.
What are some common mistakes in segmentation, targeting, and positioning?
So common mistakes include over-segmentation, under-segmentation, targeting too broadly, like trying to appeal to everyone, which can dilute brand messaging, or weak positioning, failing to differentiate from competitors or not delivering a compelling value proposition. Inconsistent messaging, like misalignment between positioning and the market communications used.
How often should companies revisit their STP strategy?
Companies should periodically revisit their STP strategy, especially in response to changes in market conditions, consumer preferences, competition, or internal business capabilities. Regular reviews ensure that the company remains relevant and continues to address the needs of its target market effectively. It can also help identify new opportunities or segments that may arise, and we're done. So I have to give a massive shout out to all the books that contributed to today's episode. Primarily, Marketing Insights from A to Z, Kotler on Marketing, Marketing 3.0, Principles of Marketing, Marketing and Introduction, Marketing Management Analysis Planning and Implementation and Control, and FAQs of Marketing, all from Philip Kotler and others such as Gary Armstrong, who is one of Philip Kotler's co-writers, Brassington and Petit's Principles of Marketing, Ashok Ranshod's Marketing Strategies, Parsons and McLaurin's Contemporary Issues in Marketing, as well as some CRM texts all contributed too. Well, that's it. Thanks for joining me. I hope this has got you in the mood to learn a bit more marketing. In the next episode, we'll probably be covering Thanksgiving, but I'm not 100% sure, so don't hold your breath. I've had to mess around with the schedule a little bit, so I also apologise if you listened to previous episodes and the next episode hasn't been the one that I've said. But to support the podcast, Please do subscribe and check out my website, marketingmadeclear.com. And if you'd like to suggest topics, correct anything I messed up, or just drop me a line, email info@marketingmadeclear.com. And please follow Marketing Made Clear on Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. Much love and good night. Helping you to elevate from beginner to a pro, ain't a better way. Marketing Made Clear, it's showtime. Wanna see you win, wanna see you shine. Let's go.